face. She brought with her an aura of rage. Though her slim body was appropriately dressed in jeans and a tank top, a loose shirt open and flapping, you could see the crazy in her face. She enjoyed dealing out the damage. You couldn't see into her head and miss that. Her movements were jerky with tension, and her eyes roved from one person to another until they found mine. They lit up like 4th of July fireworks. I could see right inside her brain, and I saw she had a gun tucked in the back of her jeans. "Uh-oh," I said very quietly.
"What more do I have to do?"
Sandra screamed. Conversations all over the bar dwindled to silence. From the corner of my eye, I saw Sam reach down under the bar. He wouldn't make it in time.
"I try to burn you up and the fire goes out."
She was still at full volume.
"I give those jerks free drugs and sex and send them to grab you and they bungle it. I try your house and the magic won't let me enter. I've tried to kill you over and over and you just won't die."
I almost felt like apologizing. At the same time, it was a good thing that Bud Dearborn had heard all this. But he was standing facing Sandra, his table between them, and I knew it would be much better if he were behind her. Sam began to move to his left, but the pass-through was to his right, and I didn't see how he could get across the bar and behind her before she worked herself up to killing me. But that wasn't Sam's plan. While Sandra was focused on me, he passed the wooden bat to Terry Belfleur, who'd been playing darts with another vet. Terry was a little crazy at times and awfully scarred, but I'd always liked him and gotten along with him well. Terry put his hand on the bat, and I was glad the jukebox was playing because it covered the little sounds. In fact, the jukebox was playing the old Whitney Houston ballad, "I Will Always Love You," which was kind of funny, actually. "Why are you always sending other people to do your jobs?" I asked, to cover the sound of Terry's quiet advance. "You some kind of coward? You think a woman can't do the job right?" Maybe taunting Sandra hadn't been such a good idea, because her hand darted to her back with shifter speed, and then the gun was out and pointing at me, and then I saw her finger begin to tighten in a moment that seemed to stretch forever, and then I saw the bat swing and connect, and Sandra went down like someone had cut her strings, and there was blood everywhere. And Terry went crazy. He crouched, screaming, and dropped the bat as if it had burned him. No matter what anyone said, the most popular thing was, "Shut up, Terry!" he howled. I never thought I'd end up sitting on the floor, cradling Terry Belfleur in my arms, rocking him and murmuring to him. But that was where I was, since he seemed to get worse if anyone else approached him. Even the ambulance people got nervous when Terry shrieked at them. He was still crouched on the balls of his feet, speckled with blood, after Sandra Pelt had gone to the hospital in Clarice. I was beholden to Terry, who had always been kind to me, even when he was having one of his bad spells. He'd come to clear away the debris when an arsonist had set fire to my kitchen. He'd offered me one of his puppies. Now he'd damaged his fragile mind to save my life. As I rocked him and patted him on the back while he wept, I listened to the steady stream of his words as the few people left in Merlot's did their best to stay a decent distance away.
"I done what he told me," Terry said. "The shining man. I kept track of Sookie, and I tried to keep her from harm. No one should hurt Sookie. I tried to watch out for her, and then today that bitch come in here, and I knew she was gonna kill Sook. I knew it. I never wanted to take blood again in my life, but I couldn't let her hurt the gal. I couldn't do it, and I never wanted to kill another person in my whole existence. I never did."
"She's not dead, Terry," I said, kissing him on the head. "You didn't kill anyone."
"Sam passed me the bat," Terry said, sounding a little more alert.
"Sure, because he couldn't get out from behind the bar in time. Thanks so much, Terry. You've been a friend to me always. God bless you for saving my life.
Suki, you knew they wanted me to watch out for you? They come to my trailer at night for months, that big blonde one and then the shining one. They always wanted to know about you.
Sure, I said, thinking, what?
They wanted to know how you were doing and who was you hanging with and who hated you and who loved you.
That's okay, I said. It was okay to tell them. Eric and my great-grandfather, I guessed, picking the damaged one, the one easiest to persuade. I'd known Eric had had someone watching me while I dated Bill and while I was on my own later. I'd guessed that my great-grandfather had had some source of knowledge, too. Whether he'd gotten the name from Eric or had discovered Terry on his own, it was very like Niall to use the handiest tool, whether or not the tool snapped during use.
I met Elvis in your woods one night, Terry said.
One of the EMTs had given him a shot, and I thought it was beginning to work.
I knew I was nuts then. He was telling me how much he liked cats. I told him I was a dog person myself.
The vampire formerly known as Elvis had not translated well, because his system had been so saturated with drugs when he'd been brought over by an ardent fan in the Memphis morgue. Bubba, as he preferred to be called now, had a preference for feline blood, luckily for Terry's beloved Catahoula, Annie.
We got along real well, Terry was saying, and his voice was getting slower and sleepier. I guess I better go home now.
We're going to take you out back to Sam's trailer, I said. That's where you'll wake up. Didn't want Terry waking up in a panic. God, no. The police had taken my statement in a sketchy kind of way, and at least three people had heard Sandra say she'd firebombed the bar. Of course, I'd been at the bar much later than I'd planned, and it was now dark. I knew that Eric was outside waiting for me, and I wanted more than anything to get up and foist the problem of Terry on someone else, but I simply couldn't. What he'd done for me had damaged Terry even more, and I had no way to pay him back. It didn't bother me that he'd been keeping track of me, okay, spying on me, for Eric, before Eric was my lover, or for my great-grandfather. It hadn't done me any harm. Since I knew Terry, I knew there had to have been pressure involved, of one kind or another. Sam and I helped Terry to his feet, and we began to move, going down the hall that led to the back of the bar and across the employee parking lot to Sam's trailer.
They promised they wouldn't let nothing happen to my dog,
Terry whispered.
And they promised the dreams would stop.
Did they keep their promises? I asked back, my voice just as quiet.
Yes,
he said gratefully.
No more dreams, and I got my dog.
That didn't seem to be so much to ask. I should be angrier at Terry, but I couldn't scrape up the emotional energy. I was all worn out. Eric was standing in the shadow of the trees. He stayed back so his presence wouldn't agitate Terry. From the sudden stiffness in Sam's face, I knew he was aware Eric was there, but Sam didn't say anything. We got Terry settled on Sam's couch, and when he drifted away into the stream of sleep, I hugged Sam.
Thanks, I said.
For what?
For passing Terry the bat.
Sam stepped back.
It was all I could think of to do. I couldn't clear the bar without alerting her. She had to be surprised or it was all over.
She's that strong?
Yeah, he said. And she's convinced her world would be okay if it weren't for you, sounded like. Fanatics are hard to beat down. They keep coming.
Are you thinking about the people who are trying to get Merlot's closed? His smile was bitter.
Maybe I am. I can't believe this is happening in our country and me, a veteran, born and bred in the USA.
I feel guilty, Sam. Some of this has happened because of me. The firebombing. Sandra wouldn't have done that if I hadn't been there. And the fight. Maybe you should let me go. I can work somewhere else, you know.
Do you want to?
I couldn't read the expression on his face, but at least it wasn't relief. No, of course not.
Then you have a job. We're a package deal.
He smiled, and somehow it didn't light up his blue eyes the way his smiles usually did, but he meant what he said. Shifter or not, snarly-brained or not, I could tell that much. Thanks, Sam. I better go see what my better half wants.
Whatever Eric is to you, Sook, he's not your better half.
I paused, my hand on the doorknob, and couldn't think of anything to say to that. So I just left. Eric was waiting, but not patiently. He took my face between his big hands and examined it under the harsh glare of the security lights on the corners of the bar. India came out the back way, gave us a startled look, and got in her car and drove off. Sam stayed in the trailer.
I want you to move in with me, Eric said. You can stay in one of the upstairs bedrooms if you want, the one we usually use. You don't have to stay down in the dark with me. I don't want you to be alone. I don't want to feel your fear one more time. It makes me crazy to know someone is attacking you and I'm not there.
We had gotten into the habit of making love in the largest upstairs bedroom. Waking up in the windowless room downstairs gave me the heebie-jeebies. Now Eric was offering that room to me permanently. I knew this was a big deal for Eric, a major deal, and it was huge for me too. But a decision this big couldn't be made at a moment when I was not myself, and tonight I wasn't myself. We need to talk, I said. Do you have time?
Tonight I'm making time, he said. Are the fairies at your house?
I called Claude on my cell. When he answered, I could hear the noise of hooligans in the background. I'm just checking to see where you are before Eric and I go to the house, I said.
We're staying at the club tonight, Claude answered. Have a good time with your vampire hunk, cousin.
Eric followed me over to my house. He'd brought the car, because as soon as he'd known I was in danger, he'd known it had passed, and he could take the time to drive. I poured myself a glass of wine, unusual for me, and I microwaved some bottled blood for Eric. We sat in the living room. I pulled up my legs onto the couch and swung around with my back against the arm to face him. He angled toward me on the other end. Eric, I know you don't ask people to stay in your house lightly, so I want you to know how touched and flattered I am that you invited me.
Right away, I realized I'd said the wrong thing. That sounded way too impersonal.
Eric's blue eyes narrowed.
Oh, think nothing of it, he said coldly.
I didn't say that right. I took a deep breath. Listen, I love you. I feel thrilled that you want us to live together. He looked a little more relaxed. But before I make up my mind whether to do that, we need to get some stuff straight.
Stuff?
You married me to protect me. You hired Terry Balfleur to spy on me, and you applied pressure where he couldn't take it to get him to comply, Eric said.
That happened before I knew you, Sookie.
Yeah, I get that. But it's the nature of the pressure you applied to a man whose mental state is so wobbly. It's the way you got me to marry you without knowing what I was doing.
You wouldn't have done it otherwise,
Eric said, as always, practical and to the point. You're right. I wouldn't, I said, trying to smile at him, but it wasn't easy. And Terry wouldn't have told you things about me if you'd offered him money. I know you see this as the smart way to do business, and I'm sure a lot of people would agree with you. Eric was trying to follow my thinking, but I could tell he wasn't making any sense of it. I kept struggling upstream. We're both living with this bond. I'm sure sometimes you would rather I didn't know what you're feeling. Would you be wanting me to live with you if we didn't have the bond? If you didn't feel it every time I was in danger, or angry, or afraid?
What a strange thing to say, my lover.
Eric took a swallow of his drink, set it down on the old coffee table.
Are you saying that if I didn't know you needed me, I wouldn't need you?
Was that what I was saying? I don't think so. What I'm trying to say is that I don't think you'd want me to live with you unless you felt like people were out to get me. Was that the same thing? Jeez Louise, I hated conversations like this. Not that I'd ever had one before.
What difference does that make?
He said, more than a trace of impatience in his voice.
If I want you with me, I want you. The circumstances don't matter.
But they do matter. And we're so different.
What?
Well, there are so many things you take for granted that I don't. Eric rolled his eyes. A total guy.
Like what?
I groped around for an example. Well, like Appius having sex with Alexei. It was not a big deal for you, even though Alexei was 13. Eric's maker, Appius Livius Okella, had become a vampire during the time when Romans ruled much of the world.
Sookie, it was what you call a done deal long before I even knew I had a brother. In Okella's time, people were reckoned practically grown at 13. They were even married that young. Okella never understood some of the changes in society that came with the centuries. And Alexei and Okella are both dead now.
Eric shrugged.
There was another side of that coin, you remember? Alexei used his youth, his childlike looks, to disarm all the vampires and humans around him. Even Pam was loath to put him down, though she knew how destructive he was, how insane. And she's the most ruthless vampire I know. He was a drain on all of us, sucking the will and force from us with the depth of his need.
And with that unexpectedly poetic sentence, Eric was done talking about Alexei and Okella. His whole face turned stony. I recalled my main point, our irreconcilable differences. What about the fact that you're going to outlive me for, like, forever?
We can take care of that easily enough.
I just stared at him.
What?
Eric said, almost genuinely amazed.
You don't want to live forever? With me?
I don't know. I said, finally. I tried to imagine it. The night, forever, endless. But with Eric. I said, you know, Eric, I can't. And then I stopped dead. I'd almost insulted him unforgivably. I knew he felt the wave of doubt emanating from me. I'd almost said, I just can't imagine you sticking around after I start to look old. Though there were a few more topics I had hoped we'd cover in our rare tete-a-tete, I felt the conversation was teetering on the edge of Disaster Canyon. Maybe it was lucky there was knocking at the back door. I'd heard the car coming, but my attention had been so focused on my companion that I hadn't really registered its meaning. Amelia Broadway and Bob Jessup were at the back door. Amelia looked the same as ever, healthy and fresh-faced, her short brown hair tousled and her skin and eyes clear. Bob, not much taller than Amelia and equally lean, was a small-boned guy who looked kind of like a sexy Mormon missionary. His black-framed glasses managed to look retro instead of geeky. He was wearing jeans, a black-and-white plaid shirt, and tasseled loafers. He'd been a very cute cat, but his attraction as a guy escaped me, or rather it showed itself to me only now and then. I beamed at them. It felt great to see Amelia, and I felt relieved that my conversation with Eric had been interrupted. We did have to talk about our future, but I had a creepy feeling that finishing that conversation would make both of us unhappy. Postponing it probably wouldn't change that outcome, but both Eric and I had enough on our plates of problems.
Come on in, I said. Eric's here, and he'll be glad to see you both.
Of course, that wasn't true. Eric was completely indifferent about ever seeing Amelia again in his life, his long, long life, and Bob didn't even register on Eric's radar. But Eric smiled, though not a large smile, and told them how glad he was they'd come to visit me, though there was a bit of a question in his voice, since he didn't know why they were here. No matter how long a talk Eric and I had, we never seemed to cover enough ground. With a huge effort, Amelia repressed a frown. She was not a fan of the Viking, and she was a very clear broadcaster, so I got that with as much volume as if she'd yelled out loud. Bob eyed Eric with caution, and as soon as I'd explained the bedroom situation to Amelia, of course she'd assumed they'd be upstairs, Bob vanished into the room across from mine with their bags. After a few minutes fiddling around in there, he ducked into the hall bathroom. Bob had gotten good at evasiveness while he was a cat. "Eric," Amelia said, stretching unselfconsciously, "how are things going at Fantasia? How's the new management?" She couldn't know she'd hit a nerve. And when Eric's eyes narrowed, I suspected that he thought she'd said that on purpose to rile him, Amelia was staring at her toes as she touched them with the palms of her hands. I wondered if I could do that, and then my mind snapped back to the current moment.
"Business is going all right," Eric said. "Victor has opened some new clubs close by."
Amelia understood immediately that this was a bad development, but she was smart enough not to say anything. Honestly, it was like being in the room with someone who was shouting her inmost thoughts. "Victor's the smiley guy who was out in the yard the night of the takeover, right?" she said, straightening and rotating her head from side to side.
"Yes,"
Eric said, one corner of his mouth going up in a sardonic look.
"The smiley guy."
"So, Sook, what troubles do you have now?" Amelia asked me, evidently considering that she'd been polite enough to Eric. She was ready to plunge into whatever problem I described.
"Yes,"
Eric said, looking at me with hard eyes.
"What troubles do you have now?"
"I was just going to get Amelia to reinforce the wards around the house," I said casually. "Since so much stuff has happened at Merlot's, I was feeling kind of insecure."
"So she called me," Amelia said pointedly.
Eric looked from me to Amelia. He looked mighty displeased.
"But now that the bitch has been cornered, Sookie, surely the threat's been removed?"
"What?" Amelia asked. It was her turn to look from face to face. "What happened tonight, Sookie?"
I told her, briefly. "I'd still feel better if you made sure the wards were in place, though."
"That's one of the things I've come to do, Sookie."
For some reason, she smiled broadly at Eric. Bob sidled in then and took up a position beside Amelia, but slightly behind her.
"Those weren't my kittens,"
he told me, and Eric gaped. I'd seldom seen him genuinely startled. It was all I could do to keep from laughing.
"I mean, wares can't breed with the animal they turn into. So I don't think those were my kittens, especially since, think about it, I was only a cat by magic, not a genetic ware."
Amelia said, "Honey, we've talked about this. You don't need to be embarrassed. It was a perfectly natural thing to do. I admit I got a little snitty about it, but you know, the whole thing was my fault anyway."
"Don't worry about it, Bob. Sam already spoke up in your defense." I smiled at Bob, who looked relieved. Eric decided to ignore this exchange.
"Sookie, I need to get back to Fantasia."
We would never have a chance to say the things we needed to say at this rate.
"Okay, Eric. Tell Pam I said hello if you two are back to speaking."
"She's a better friend to you than you know,"
Eric said darkly. I didn't know how to respond to that, and he turned so quickly my eyes couldn't track him. I heard his car door slam outside, and then he was driving down the driveway. No matter how many times I saw it, I still found it amazing that vamps could move so fast. I'd hoped to have a chance to talk more to Amelia that night, but she and Bob were ready to turn in after their drive. They'd left New Orleans after a full day's work, Amelia at the Genuine Magic Shop and Bob at the Happy Cutter. After 15 minutes or so of going to and fro between the bathroom and the kitchen and the car, they became silent in the room across the hall. I'd taken off my shoes, and I padded into the kitchen to lock up. I was just expelling a sigh of relief at the end of the day when there was a very quiet knock at the back door. I jumped like a frog. Who could be there at this time of night? I looked out across the back porch very cautiously. Bill. I hadn't seen him since his sister, Judith, had come to see him. I debated for a second, then decided to slip outside to talk to him. Bill was a lot of things to me. Neighbor, friend, first lover. I did not fear him.
Sookie,
he said, his cool, smooth voice as relaxing as a massage.
You have guests?
Amelia and Bob, I explained. They just got here from New Orleans. The fairies aren't here tonight. They stay in Monroe most nights lately.
Shall we stay out here so we won't wake your friends?
It was news to me that our conversation was going to last that long. Apparently, Bill hadn't come over just to borrow a cup of blood. I waved my hand toward the lawn furniture, and we sat in the chairs, already placed at a companionable angle. The warm night with its myriad small sounds closed around us like an envelope. The security light gave the backyard strange patterns of dark and brightness. When the silence had lasted long enough for me to realize I was sleepy, I said, "How's things going at your house, Bill? Is Judith still staying with you?"
"I'm fully healed from the silver poisoning," he said.
I noticed you looked good," I said. His skin had regained its pale clarity, and even his hair looked more lustrous. "Much better. So Judith's blood worked."
"Yes. But now..."
He looked off into the night forest. "Uh-oh. She wants to keep on living with you?"
"Yes,"
he said, sounding relieved he hadn't had to spell it out.
"She does."
"I thought you admired her because she looked so much like your first wife. Judith told me that's why crazy Lorena changed Judith over, to keep you with her. I mean, sorry to bring up bad stuff."
"It's true. Judith does look like my first wife in many respects. Her face is the same shape, her voice very much like my wife's. Her hair is the same color my wife's was when she was a child. And Judith was raised very gently, like my wife."
"So I would have predicted that would make you happy with Judith," I said.
"But not."
He sounded rueful, and he kept his eyes on the trees, carefully averting his gaze from my face.
"And in fact, that's why I didn't call Judith when I realized how sick I was. I had to part with her the last time we were together because of her overwhelming obsession with me."
"Oh,"
I said, my voice very small. "But you did the right thing, Sookie. She came to me and freely offered her blood. Since you invited her here without my knowledge, I'm at least not guilty of using her. My fault lies in letting her stay after I healed."
"And why'd you do that?"
"Because I hoped somehow my feelings for her had changed, that I could have a genuine love for her. That would have freed me from..."
His voice trailed off. He might have finished the sentence, "loving you," or maybe, "freed me from the debt I owed her for healing me." I did feel a little better now that I knew he was glad to be well, even though the price was that he had to deal with Judith. And I could understand how awkward and unpleasant it would be to be saddled with a houseguest who adored you when you didn't return the emotion. Who was the one who'd saddled him? Well, that would be me. Of course, I hadn't known any of the emotional background. Distressed by Bill's condition, I'd reasoned that some of Bill's bloodline could heal him, and I'd found that there was such a person and tracked her down. I'd further assumed Bill hadn't done that himself for some perverse pride, or perhaps even from a suicidal depression. I'd underestimated Bill's desire to live.
"What do you plan to do about Judith?" I asked anxiously, scared to hear his answer.
"He need not do anything," a quiet voice said from the trees. I came up out of my chair like someone had just shot a few volts through it, and Bill had a big reaction. He turned his head, and his eyes widened. That was it, but for a vampire, that indicates major surprise.
Judith? I said.
She stepped out of the tree line, far enough for me to recognize her. The security light in the backyard didn't extend that far, and I could only just be sure it was her.
You keep breaking my heart, Bill, she said.
I eased away from the chair. Maybe I could slink back into the house. Maybe I could avoid witnessing another major scene, because honestly, the day had been chock full of them.
No, stay, Miss Stackhouse, Judith said.
She was a short, round woman with a sweet face and an abundance of hair, and she carried herself as if she were 6 feet tall.
Damn it.
You two obviously need to talk, I said cravenly.
Any conversation with Bill about love has to include you, she said.
Oh, poop. I so did not want to be present for this. I stared down at my feet.
Judith, stop,
Bill said, his voice as calm as ever.
I came over to talk to my friend, whom I haven't seen for weeks.
I heard your conversation, Judith said simply. I followed you here for the express purpose of listening to whatever you had to say to her.
I know that you're not making love to this woman. I know that she's claimed by another. And I also know that you want her more than you ever wanted me. I will not have sex with a man who pities me. I will not live with a man who doesn't want me. I'm worth more than that. I'll stop loving you if it takes me the rest of my existence. If you'll remain here a few moments, I'll return to your house and pack my things and be gone.
I was impressed. That was a damn fine speech, and I hoped she meant every word. Even as I had the thought, Judith was gone. Whoosh! And Bill and I were alone together. Suddenly, he was right in front of me, and he put his cold arms around me. It didn't seem like a betrayal of Eric to let Bill simply hold me for a moment.
You had sex with her?
I said, trying to sound neutral.
She had saved me. She seemed to expect it. I felt it was the right thing to do, he said.
As if Judith had sneezed so he'd lent her a handkerchief. I really couldn't think of what to say. Men, dead or alive, they could be exactly the same. I stepped back and he dropped his arms instantly.
Do you really love me?
I said, out of either insanity or sheer curiosity.
Or have we just been through so much that you think you ought to?
He smiled.
Only you would say that. I love you. I think you're beautiful and kind and good, and yet you stand up for yourself. You have a lot of understanding and compassion, but you're not a pushover. And to descend a few levels to the carnal, you have a pair of breasts that should win the Miss America tit competition, if there were such a thing.
That's an unusual bunch of compliments. I had a hard time suppressing my own smile.
You're an unusual woman.
Good night, Bill, I said.
Just then my cell phone rang. I jumped a mile. I'd forgotten it was in my pocket. When I looked at the number, it was a local one I didn't recognize. No call at this hour of the night was a good one. I held up a finger to ask Bill to wait for a moment, and I answered it with a cautious, "Hello?"
"Sookie," said Sheriff Dearborn. "I thought you ought to know that Sandra Pelt escaped from the hospital. She snuck out the window while Kenya was talking to Dr. Tonneson. I don't want you to be worried. If you need us to send a car out to your house, we will. You got someone with you?"
I was so shocked I couldn't reply for a second. Then I said,
"Yes, I have someone with me."
Bill's dark eyes were serious now. He stepped closer and put one hand on my shoulder.
"You want me to send a patrol car? I don't think that crazy woman will head out to find you. I think she'll find somewhere to hole up and recover. But it seemed like the right thing, telling you, even though it's the middle of the night."
"Definitely the right thing to do, Sheriff. I don't think I need more help out here. I've got friends here. Good friends."
And I met Bill's eyes. Bud Dearborn said the same things all over again several times, but eventually I got to hang up and think about the implications.
I thought one line of troubles was closed, but I'd been wrong. While I was explaining to Bill, the weariness that had manifested itself earlier began to sweep over me like a blanket of gray. By the time I'd finished answering his questions, I could barely put two words together.
"Don't worry," Bill said. "Go to bed. I'll watch tonight. I've already fed, and I wasn't busy. It doesn't feel like a good night for work anyway."
Bill had created and maintained a CD called The Vampire Directory, which was a catalog of all living vampires. It was in popular demand not only among the undead, but also among the living, particularly marketing groups. However, the version sold to the public was limited to vampires who'd given their permission to be included, a much shorter list. There were still vampires who didn't want to be known as vampires, odd as that seemed to me. It was easy to forget, in today's vampire-saturated culture, that there were still holdouts. Vampires who didn't want to be known to the public in general. Vampires who preferred to sleep in the earth or in abandoned buildings rather than in a house or apartment. And why I was thinking of this? Well, it was better than thinking about Sandra Pelt.
"Thanks, Bill," I said gratefully. "I warn you, she's vicious to the nth degree."
"You've seen me fight," he said.
"Yep, but you don't know her. She's completely underhanded, and she won't give you any warning."
"I'm a few jumps ahead of her then, since I know that about her."
"Huh? Okay," I mumbled, putting one foot in front of the other in more or less a straight line.
"Night, Bill."
"Night, Sookie,"
he said quietly.
"Lock the doors."
I did, and I went into my room and put on my nightshirt. And then I was in bed, and under that gray blanket.
Chapter 8. Schools are always more or less the same, aren't they? There's always the smell, a mixture of chalk, school lunches, floor wax, books. The echo of children's voices, the louder voices of teachers. The art on the walls and the decorations on each room's door. The little red ditch kindergarten was no different. I held Hunter's hand while Remy trailed behind us. Every time I saw Hunter, he seemed to look a bit more like my cousin Hadley, his dead mother. He had her dark eyes and hair, and his face was losing its baby roundness and growing more oval like hers. Poor Hadley. She'd had a tough life. Mostly of her own making. In the end, she'd found true love, become a vampire, and been killed for jealousy's sake. Hadley's life had been eventful, but short. That was why I was standing in for her, and for a moment I wondered how she'd have felt about that. This should be her job, taking her son to his first school, the kindergarten he'd be attending in the fall. The purpose of the visit was to help the incoming kindergartners become a little familiar with the idea of school, with the look of the rooms and the desks and the teachers. Some of the little people going through the building were looking around with curiosity, not fear. Some of them were silent and wide-eyed. That was the way my nephew, Hunter, would look to other people, but in my head, Hunter was chattering away. Hunter was telepathic, as I was. This was the most closely guarded secret I held. I wanted Hunter to grow up as normally as possible. The more soups who knew about Hunter, the higher the likelihood someone would snatch him away because telepaths were useful. There was sure to be someone ruthless enough to take such a terrible action. I don't think Remy, his father, had even considered that yet. Remy was worried about Hunter's acceptance among the humans around him, and that was a big deal, too. Kids could be incredibly cruel when they sensed you were different. I knew that all too well. It's kind of obvious when people are having a mind-to-mind conversation, if you know the cues. Their faces change expression when they look at each other, much as they would if the conversation were out loud. So I was looking away from the child frequently and keeping my smile steady. Hunter was too little to learn how to conceal our communication, so I'd have to do it.
"Will all these kids fit in one room?"
he asked.
Out loud, I reminded him quietly. No, you'll be divided into groups, and then you'll hang out with one group all day, Hunter.
I didn't know if the Red Ditch Kindergarten had the same schedule as the higher grades, but I was sure it would last past lunch anyway. Your dad will bring you in the morning, and someone will come get you in the afternoon.
Who?
I wondered, and then remembered Hunter was listening to me.
Your dad will fix that, I said. Look, this room is the seal room. See the big picture of the seal? And that room is the pony room.
Is there a pony?
Hunter was an optimist. I don't think so, but I bet there are lots of pictures of ponies in the room. All the doors were open, and the teachers were inside, smiling at the children and their parents, doing their best to seem welcoming and warm. Some of them, of course, had more of a struggle doing this than others. The pony room teacher, Mrs. Gristidi, was a nice enough woman, or at least that was what my quick look told me. Hunter nodded. We ventured into the puppy room and met with Miss O'Fallon. We were back in the hall after 3 minutes.
Not the puppy room, I told Remy, speaking very quietly. You can designate, right?
Yeah, we can. Once. I can say one room I definitely don't want my kid to be in, he said. Most people use that option in case the teacher is too close to the family, like a relative, or if the families have had some quarrel.
Not the puppy room, Hunter said, looking scared.
Miss O'Fallon looked pretty on the outside, but she was rotten on the inside.
What's wrong?
Remy asked, his voice also on a confidential level.
Tell you later, I murmured. Let's go see something else.
Trailed by Remy, we made visits to the other three rooms. All the other teachers seemed okay, though Mrs. Boyle seemed a little burned out. Her thoughts were brisk and had an edge of impatience, and her smile was just a bit brittle. I didn't say anything to Remy. If he could turn down only one teacher, Miss O'Fallon was the most dangerous. We went back to Mrs. Gristidi's room because Hunter definitely liked the ponies. There were two other parents there, both towing little girls. I squeezed Hunter's hand gently to remind him of the rules. He looked up at me, and I nodded, trying to encourage the boy. He let go of my hand and went over to the reading area, picking up one of the books and turning the pages.
Do you like to read, Hunter?
Mrs. Gristidi asked.
I like books. I can't read yet.
Hunter put the book back where it belonged, and I gave him a mental pat on the back. He smiled to himself and picked up another book, this one a Dr. Seuss about dogs.
I can tell Hunter's been read to,
the teacher said, smiling at Remy and me. Remy introduced himself.
I'm Hunter's dad, and this is Hunter's cousin, he said, inclining his head toward me. Sookie's standing in for Hunter's mom tonight since she's passed away.
Mrs. Gristidi absorbed that.
Well, I'm glad to see both of you, she said. Hunter seems like a bright little boy.
I noticed the girls were approaching him. They were longtime friends, I could tell, and their parents went to church together. I made a mental note to advise Remy to pick a church and start attending. Hunter was going to need all the backup he could get. The girls began picking up books, too. Hunter smiled at the girl with a dark Dutch boy bob, giving her that sideways look shy children use to evaluate potential playmates. She said,
I like this one,
and pointed to Where the Wild Things Are.
I never read it,
Hunter said doubtfully. It looked a little scary to him.
Do you play with blocks?
The girl with the light brown ponytail asked.
Yeah.
Hunter walked over to the carpeted play area that was for construction, I decided, because there were all sizes of blocks and puzzles around it. In a minute, the three were building something that took on life in their minds. Remy smiled. He was hoping this was the way every day would go. Of course, it wouldn't. Even now, Hunter was glancing dubiously at the ponytail girl because she was getting angry about the brunettes grabbing all the alphabet blocks. The other parents looked at me with some curiosity, and one of the mothers said,
You don't live here?
No, I said. I live over in Bonton, but Hunter wanted me to go around with him today, and he's my favorite little cousin. I'd almost called him my nephew, because he called me Aunt Sookie.
Remy,
the same woman said.
You're Hank Savoy's great-nephew, right?
Remy nodded.
Yeah, we came up here after Katrina and we stayed, he said.
He shrugged.
Nothing you could do about losing everything to Katrina. She was a bitch.
There was a lot of head shaking, and I felt the sympathy roll over Remy. Maybe that goodwill would extend to Hunter. While they were all bonding, I drifted back to Miss O'Fallon's door. The young woman was smiling at two children who were wandering around her brightly decorated classroom. One set of parents was staying right beside their little one. Maybe they were picking up on the vibe, or maybe they were just protective. I drifted close to Miss O'Fallon, and I opened my mouth to speak. I would have said, "You keep those fantasies to yourself. Don't even think of such things when you're in the same room with kids." But I had a second thought. She knew I'd come with Hunter. Would he become a target for her evil imagination if I threatened her? I couldn't be around to protect him. I couldn't stop her. I couldn't think of a way to take her out of the equation. She hadn't yet done anything wrong in the eyes of the law or morality, yet. So what if she imagined taping children's mouths shut? She hadn't done it.
"Haven't all of us fantasized about awful things we haven't done?" she asked herself, because the answer made her feel that she was still okay. She didn't know I could hear her.
Was I any better than Miss O'Fallon? That awful question ran through my mind more quickly than it takes to write the sentences. I thought, yeah, I'm not as scary because I'm not in charge of kids. The people I want to hurt are adults, and they're killers themselves. That didn't make me any better, but it made O'Fallon a lot worse. I'd been staring at her long enough to spook her.
"Did you want to ask something about the curriculum?" she asked finally, a little edge to her voice.
"Why did you become a teacher?" I asked. "I thought it would be a wonderful thing to teach little ones the first things they needed to know to get along in the world," she said, as if she'd pressed the button on a recording. She meant, "I had a teacher who tortured me when no one was looking, and I liked the small and helpless."
"Hmm," I murmured. The other visitors left the room, and we were alone.
"You need therapy," I said, quietly and quickly. "If you act on what you see in your head, you'll hate yourself, and you'll ruin the lives of other people just the same way yours was ruined. Don't let her win. Get help." She gaped at me.
"I don't know. What on earth?"
"I'm so serious," I said, answering her next unspoken question. "I'm so serious."
"I'll do it," she said, as if the words were ripped from her mouth.
"I swear, I'll do it."
"You'd be better off," I said. I gave her some more eye to eye. Then I left the puppy room. Maybe I'd frightened her enough, or jolted her enough, that she'd actually do what she'd promised. If not, well, I'd have to think of another tactic.
"My job here is done, Grasshopper," I said to myself, earning a nervous look from a very young father. I smiled at him, and after a bit of hesitation, he smiled back. I rejoined Remy and Hunter, and we completed our kindergarten tour without any further incident. Hunter gave me a questioning look, a very anxious look, and I nodded.
"I took care of her,"
I said, and I prayed that was true. It was really too early for supper, but Remy suggested we go to Dairy Queen and treat Hunter to some ice cream, and I agreed. Hunter was half anxious, half excited after the school expedition. I tried calming him with a little head-to-head conversation.
"Can you take me to school the first day, Aunt Sookie?"
he asked, and I had to steel myself to answer.
"No, Hunter. That's your daddy's job," I told him. "But when that day comes, you call me when you get home and tell me all about it, okay?"
Hunter gave me a big-eyed, soulful look.
"But I'm scared."
I gave him skeptical. "You may be nervous, but everyone else will feel the same way.
This is your chance to make friends, so remember to keep your mouth closed until you've gotten everything straight in your head."
"Or they won't like me?"
"No," I said, wanting to be absolutely clear. "They won't understand you. There's a big difference."
"You like me?"
"You little rascal, you know I like you," I said, smiling at him and brushing his hair back. I glanced over at Remy, standing in line at the counter to order our blizzards. He waved to me and made a face at Hunter.
Remy was making a huge effort to take all this in stride. He was growing into his role as father of an exceptional child. I figured he might get to relax in 12 years, give or take a few.
You know your dad loves you, and you know he wants what's best for you, I said.
He wants me to be like all the other kids,
Hunter said, half sad, half resentful.
He wants you to be happy, and he knows that the more people who know about this gift you have, the chances are you won't be happy.
I know it's not fair to tell you that you have to keep a secret, but this is the only secret you have to keep. If anyone talks to you about it, tell your dad or call me. If you think someone's weird, you tell your dad. If someone tries to bad touch you, you tell. I just scared him now, but he swallowed and said,
I know about bad touching.
You're a smart boy, and you're going to have lots of friends. This is just a thing about you they don't need to know.
Because it's bad?
Hunter's face looked pinched and desperate.
Heck no, I said, outraged. Nothing wrong with you, buddy. But you know what we are is different, and people don't always understand different.
End of lecture. I gave him a kiss on the cheek. Hunter, you get us some napkins, I said in the regular way, as Remy picked up the plastic tray with our blizzards. I'd gotten a chocolate chip one, and my mouth was watering when we distributed the napkins and dug into our separate cups of sinful goodness. A young woman with chin-length black hair came into the restaurant, spotted us, and waved in an uncertain way.
Looks bored, it's Aaron, Remy said.
Hey, Aaron.
Hunter waved back enthusiastically, his hand moving like a little metronome. Aaron came over, still looking as though she weren't sure of her welcome.
Hi, she said, looking around the table. Mr. Hunter, sir, it's good to see you this fine afternoon.
Hunter beamed back at her. He liked being called Mr. Hunter. Aaron had cute round cheeks, and her almond eyes were a rich brown.
This is my Aunt Sookie, Hunter said with pride.
Sookie, this is Aaron,
Remy said. I could tell from his thoughts that he liked the young woman more than a little.
Aaron, I've heard so much about you, I said. It's nice to put a face with a name. Hunter wanted me to come over to go around the kindergarten rooms with him.
How did that go? Aaron asked, genuinely interested. Hunter started to tell her all about it, and Remy jumped up to pull over a chair for Aaron. We had a good time after that. Hunter seemed to be really fond of Aaron, and Aaron returned the feeling. Aaron was also quite interested in Hunter's dad, and Remy was on the verge of being nuts about her. All in all, it wasn't a bad afternoon to be able to read minds, I figured. Hunter said,
Miss Aaron, Aunt Sookie says she can't go with me to the first day of school. Would you?
Aaron was both startled and pleased.
If your dad says it's okay, and if I can get off work, she said, careful to put some conditions on it in case Remy had some objection, or they'd quit dating by late August.
You're so sweet to ask me.
While Remy took Hunter to the men's room, Aaron and I were left to regard each other with curiosity. How long have you and Remy been seeing each other? I asked. That seems safe enough.
Just a month, she said. I like Remy, and I think we might have something, but it's too soon to tell. I don't want Hunter to start depending on me in case it doesn't work out. Plus,
she hesitated for a long minute.
I understand that Kristen Duchesne thought there was something wrong with Hunter. She told everyone that. But I really care about that little boy.
The question was clear in her eyes.
He's different, I said. But there's nothing wrong with him. He's not mentally ill, he doesn't have a learning disability, and he's not possessed by the devil.
I was smiling just a little when I got to the end of the sentence.
I'd never seen any signs of that, she agreed. She was smiling, too.
I don't think I've seen the whole picture, though.
I wasn't about to tell Hunter's secret.
He needs special love and care, I said. He's never really had a mom, and I'm sure having someone stable in his life, filling that role, would help. And that's not gonna be you.
She said that as if she were half asking a question.
No, I said,
relieved to get a chance to set the record straight. That's not gonna be me. Remy seems like a nice guy, but I'm seeing someone else. I scraped up one more spoonful of chocolate and sugar. Erin looked down at her glass of Pepsi, thinking her own thoughts. Of course, I was thinking them right along with her. She'd never liked Kristen and didn't think much of her mental ability. She did like Remy more and more, and she loved Hunter.
Okay, she said, having reached an inner conclusion.
Okay.
She looked up at me and nodded. I nodded right back. It seemed we'd arrived at an understanding. When the men folk came back from their trip to the restroom, I said goodbye to them.
Oh, wait, Remy, can you step outside for a minute with me if Erin wouldn't mind keeping an eye on Hunter?
I'd love to, she said.
I hugged Hunter again and gave him a pat and a smile as I moved toward the door. Remy followed me, an apprehensive expression on his face. We stood a little away from the door.
You know Hadley left the rest of her estate to me, I said. This had been weighing on me.
The lawyer told me.
Remy's face wasn't giving anything away, but of course I have other methods.
He was calm through and through. You aren't mad?
No, I don't want nothing of Hadley's.
But for Hunter, his college, there wasn't much cash, but there was some good jewelry and I could sell it.
I got a college fund started for him, Remy said. One of my great aunts says she's going to leave what she's got to him since she doesn't have any kids of her own. Hadley put me through hell, and she didn't even care enough about Hunter to plan for him. I don't want it.
In all fairness, she didn't expect to die young. In fact, she didn't expect to die ever, I said. It's my belief she didn't put Hunter in her will because she didn't want anyone to know about him and come looking for him to use him as a hostage for her good behavior.
I hope that's the case, Remy said. I mean, I hope she thought about him. But taking her money, knowing how she turned out, how she earned it, that would make me feel sick.
All right, I said. If you think it over and change your mind, call me by tomorrow night. You never know when I might go on a spending spree or put that jewelry down on the table at one of the casinos. He smiled just a little.
You're a good woman, he said,
and returned to his girlfriend and his son. I started the drive home with a clear conscience and a happier heart. I'd worked half of the early shift that day. Holly had taken my half and her own shift, so I was free. I thought of brooding over Gran's letter a little more. Mr. Cataliades' visit to us when we were babies, the Cluvial door, the deceptions Gran's lover had practiced on her. Because surely, when Gran had thought she smelled Fenton when she was seeing her husband, she was seeing Fenton in disguise. It was hard to absorb. Amelia and Bob were busy casting spells when I got back. They were walking around the perimeter of the house in opposite directions, chanting and swinging incense like the priests in the Catholic Church. Some days, I realized it was all to the good that I lived out in the country. I didn't want to break their concentration, so I wandered off into the woods. I wondered where the portal was, if I could recognize it. A thin place, Dermot had called it. Could I spot a thin place? At least I knew the general direction, and I started east. It was a warm afternoon, and I began sweating the minute I started to make my way through the woods. The sun broke through the branches in a thousand patterns, and the birds and the bugs made the thousand noises that left the woods anything but silent. It wouldn't be long until evening closed in, and the light would fracture and slant, making the footing uncertain. The birds would fall silent, and the night creatures would make their own harmony. I picked my way through the undergrowth, thinking of the night before. I wondered if Judith had packed all her things and left as she'd said she would. I wondered if Bill felt lonely now that she was gone. I assumed nothing, and no one had popped up in my yard the night before, since I'd slept through the hours of the dark and into the morning. Then all I had left to wonder about was when Sandra Pelt would try to kill me again. Just as I began to suspect that being alone in the woods wasn't a good idea, I stepped into a tiny clearing about a quarter of a mile or less, slightly southeast of my back door.
I was pretty sure this was the thin place, this little clearing. For one thing, there was no reason for it to be clear that I could see. There were wild grasses growing thickly, but there were no bushes, nothing above calf high. No vines stretched across the area, no branches drooped over it. Before I stepped out of the trees, I gave the ground a very careful examination. The last thing I needed was to be caught in some kind of fairy booby trap. But I couldn't see anything extraordinary, except perhaps a slight wavering in the air, right in the middle of the clearing. The odd spot, if I was even seeing it right, hovered at the height of my knees. It was the shape of a small and irregular circle, perhaps 15 inches in diameter, and in just that spot, the air seemed to distort, a little like a heat illusion. Was it actually hot, I wondered? I knelt in the weeds about an arm's length from the wobbly air. I plucked a long blade of grass and very nervously poked it into the distorted area. I let go of it, and it vanished. I snatched my fingers back and yipped with surprise. I had established something. I wasn't sure what. If I doubted Claude's word, here was verification he'd been telling me the truth. Very carefully, I moved a little closer to the wavery patch. "Hi, Niall," I said. "If you're listening, if you're there, I miss you." Of course, there came no answer. "I have a lot of troubles, but I expect you do too," I said, not wanting to sound whiny. "I don't know how fairy fits into this world. Are you all walking around us but invisible? Or do you have a whole nother world like Atlantis?" This was a pretty weak and one-sided conversation. "Well, I better go back to the house before it gets dark. If you need me, come see me. I do miss you," I said again. Nothing continued to happen. Feeling both pleased that I'd found the thin spot and disappointed that nothing had changed as a result, I made my way back through the woods to the house. Bob and Amelia had finished their magical doings in the yard, and Bob had fired up the grill. He and Amelia were going to cook steaks. Though I'd had ice cream with Remy and Hunter, I couldn't turn down grilled steak rubbed with Bob's secret seasoning. Amelia was cutting up potatoes to wrap in foil to go on the grill, too. I was pleased as punch. I volunteered to cook some crookneck squash. The house felt happier and safer. While we ate, Amelia told us funny stories about working in the genuine magic shop, and Bob unbent enough to imitate some of his odder colleagues in the unisex hair salon where he worked. The hairdresser Bob replaced had become so discouraged by the complications of life in post-Katrina New Orleans that she'd loaded up her car and left for Miami. Bob had gotten the job by being the first qualified person to walk in the door after the previous one had walked out. In answer to my question about whether that had been sheer coincidence, Bob just smiled. Every now and then, I saw a flash of what fascinated Amelia about Bob, who otherwise looked like a skinny, rough-haired encyclopedia salesman. I told him about Emmanuel and my emergency haircut, and he said Emmanuel had done a wonderful job. "So, the work on the wards is all done?" I asked anxiously, trying to sound casual about the change of topic. "You bet," Amelia said, looking proud. She cut another bite of steak. "They're even better now. A dragon couldn't get through them. No one who means you harm will make it." "So if a dragon was friendly?" I said, half teasing, and she swatted me with her fork. "No such thing the way I hear tell," Amelia said. "Of course, I've never seen one." "Of course." I didn't know whether to feel curious or relieved. Bob said,
"Amelia's got a surprise for you."
"Oh?" I tried to sound more relaxed than I felt. "I found the cure," she said, half proudly and half shyly. "I mean, you did ask me to when I left. I kept looking for a way to break the blood bond. I found it." "How?" I scrambled to conceal how flustered I was. "First I asked Octavia.
She didn't know because she doesn't specialize in vampire magic, but she emailed a couple of her older friends in other covens, and they scouted around. It all took time, and there were some dead ends, but eventually I came up with a spell that doesn't end in the death of one of the Bondees.
I'm stunned,
I said, which was the absolute truth.
Shall I cast it tonight?
You mean right now?
Yes, after supper.
Amelia looked slightly less happy because she wasn't getting the response she'd anticipated. Bob was looking from Amelia to me, and he too looked doubtful. He'd assumed I'd be both delighted and effusive, and that wasn't the reaction he was seeing.
I don't know.
I put my fork down.
It wouldn't hurt Eric?
As if anything can hurt a vampire that old, she said. Honestly, Sook, why you're worrying about him? I love him, I said. They both stared at me.
For real?
Amelia said in a small voice.
I told you that before you left, Amelia.
I guess I just didn't want to believe you.
You sure you'll feel that way when the bond is dissolved?
That's what I want to find out. She nodded.
You need to know, and you need to be free of him.
The sun had just set, and I could feel Eric rising. His presence was with me like a shadow, familiar, irritating, reassuring, intrusive. All those things at once.
If you're ready, do it now, I said, before I lose all courage.
This is actually a good time of day to do it, she said. Sunset, end of the day, endings in general. It makes sense. Amelia hurried to the bedroom. She returned in a couple of minutes with an envelope and three little jars, jelly jars in a chrome rack, like the kind a waitress in a diner puts on the table at breakfast. The jars were half full of a mixture of herbs. Amelia was now wearing an apron. I could see that there were objects in one of the pockets.
All right,
she said, and handed the envelope to Bob, who extracted the paper and scanned it quickly, a frown on his narrow face.
Out in the yard,
he suggested, and we three left the kitchen, crossed the back porch, and went down into the yard, smelling the steak all over again as we passed my old grill. Amelia positioned me in one spot, Bob in another, and then positioned the jelly jars, too. Bob and I each had one on the ground behind us, and there was one at the spot where she would stand. We'd form a triangle. I didn't ask any questions. I probably wouldn't have believed the answers anyway. She gave me a book of matches and handed one to Bob, too. She kept a third for herself. When I tell you, set fire to your herbs. Then walk counterclockwise around your jar 3 times, she said. Stop at your station again after the 3rd time. Then we'll say some words. Bob, you got them in your head? Sookie will need the paper. Bob looked at the words again, nodded, and passed me the paper. I could just read the script by the security light because the evening was closing in fast now that the sun was down.
Ready?
Amelia asked sharply. She looked older and colder in the twilight. I nodded, wondering if I was being truthful. Bob said,
Yes.
Then turn and light your fire, Amelia said. And like a robot, I did as I was told. I was scared to death, and I wasn't sure why. This was what I needed to do. My match struck, and I dropped it in the jelly jar. The herbs flared up with a sharp smell, and then we three were upright again and moving counterclockwise. Was this a bad thing for a Christian to be doing? Probably. On the other hand, it had never occurred to me to ask the Methodist minister if he had a ritual